ripping the other end, and then there's some plaques. West Germany, Brazil.
It's almost like Pickles has become beyond an icon.
It's a barking conspiracy theory.
This is Stealing Victory, the untold story of the 1966 World Cup heist. Episode 4, A Twist in the Tale. It was around the time of the World Cup theft that Harold Wilson is said to have coined the famous phrase, a week is a long time in politics. Perhaps it was the events over these 7 days that inspired him to come up with it. They certainly saw a dramatic reversal of fortunes. One Sunday the cup had vanished, the next it was back.
Enter stage right Pickles.
That's Martin Atherton, author of the 2008 book, The Theft of the Jules Rimet Trophy.
In yet another plot twist that could only happen in this country, you've had one of the most famous sporting trophies in the world, the most famous footballing trophy in the world, stolen from a stamp exhibition because it's not been guarded properly. And then in this nation of supposed dog lovers, a dog finds it.
I'm Tom Pettifor, crime editor for the Daily Mirror newspaper in London. In the previous episode, we heard how 5 days after the cup was stolen, a man was caught in an undercover sting operation trying to extort a ransom. But then, 2 days later, a dog called Pickles found it. One Sunday, the nation was an international joke. The next, it had a hero dog to hail as the saviour of the World Cup. Pickles' owner, Dave Corbett, picked up the £6,000 cash reward, a serious amount of money back in 1966. His dog was in such demand, he got his own agent and appeared in the film The Spy with a Cold Nose, starring Eric Sykes. And he made a star appearance on the number one children's TV show, Blue Peter.
Well, the Police and Football Association started a nationwide hunt, and they were just closing in on South London when a very extraordinary thing happened. The cup was suddenly found, but not by the police or the men who were involved in the hunt for it, but by Pickles. And here we've got Pickles. Come on, boy. Come on, Pickles. Come on. Come on.
As far as everyone was concerned, for the following 5 decades, that was pretty much the end of the story. But was it? When Dave found the cup, he was initially questioned as a person of interest, but was cleared of any wrongdoing. I headed down to the sleepy village of Lingfield in Surrey, where Dave has a lovely cottage he bought with the contested reward money in 1966. I had visited him a couple of years back and written an article for the Mirror, suggesting the story was more complex than the official version we'd all come to know over the past 50 years. I didn't know how he would receive me. We arrived during a searingly hot day in the summer of 2020.
Hello, David.
And he welcomed us with open arms.
Would you like a beer?
Clearly, I had nothing to worry about. A nice cold beer, just the kind of greeting you want on a sweltering summer's day. If only every interview started that way. Over the years, Dave has had scores of journalists and filmmakers turning up at his door, but he still clearly enjoys telling the story. Dave has a warm personality and is instantly likable. He may be 80 years old, and the power in his voice may be waning, but he is sharp and lucid and has an infectious laugh. Like many of the characters in this story, his roots lie in southeast London.
Yeah,
because the Luftwaffe bombed there and it's blazing.
Really?
Oh, it's terrible. You know, it's just sort of vivid memories of running down the stairs in the flats and going to the big shelters you had there. You go down a shelter and a lot of people come out and their houses were gone. The street was gone.
Dave was born in Rotherhithe in January 1940, 5 months after the outbreak of the Second World War. Throughout the Blitz, the docks, warehouses, wharves, railway lines, factories and power stations that dominated this part of London were targeted. More than 20,000 mostly working-class Londoners were killed in the bombing. His house was a mile east of Tower Bridge on the south bank of the River Thames as it wends its way out of the city. It's fitting for a story so entwined with the river that Dave was a Thames lighterman in 1966. He operated a flat-bottom barge called a lighter, which collected goods from huge cargo ships. Dave would then deliver to the dockers on the shore. It's hard to imagine it now, but in 1966, this was the beating heart of the city. It connected us with the rest of the world.
Pubs opened at 6 o'clock in the morning. And they used to go to the old dockers, like, you know. They used to go in and
have a drink
before they started work. And I used to have to get up at 4 o'clock. Mum give me breakfast, made sure I got my vest on, and I had to walk through the docks. It was all dark.
It was empty, yeah.
And then get on a bus, which was then full of all the cleaners used to go. You know, used to go and clean all the offices and all that early in the morning, so they had these early buses to Greenwich and then train again to Woolwich, walk through the subway to North Woolwich where the pier was and the tug was there. And then I'd done a 16-hour shift.
Jesus.
Yeah, you just get a life out of me walking through them docks, I tell you.
The docks were a tough place. The work was hard and so were the men. And as well as being a hub for international trade, it was a hive of criminal activity.
Was there, was a bit of a culture of things being bought and sold, shall we say?
Yeah. The thing that I could remember was the crews of the ships that come in. At that time, it was watches, you know, Swiss watches. And the old crew member would come up to you, would you like to buy a watch? And the old customs looking, what's he doing?
The docks had provided thousands of relatively well-paid jobs for those willing to do the back-breaking work. They were the epicentre of the British Empire in the 19th century. Hundreds of thousands of cargoes of meat, tobacco, grain, as well as luxury goods were unloaded on the quayside. So with so much valuable gear around, it was a magnet for thieves. By the time of our story, the docks were in decline. Dave was still a Thames lighterman, but he'd moved from Rotherhithe a few miles south to Upper Norwood. Then, on the 27th of March 1966, his life would change forever.
My brother's wife was expecting a baby, so that was on our mind. And we had no phone in them days. There's a phone box across the road. So that early evening, I went out to phone John to see any developments. And I said, oh, we'll take Pickles out for a run. We lived in the garden flat. It was a big old Victorian house, two three flats and a big frontage. And there's a drive there where you park your cars. You come out, we went up the steps out to the level. He runs around and then he goes over to my neighbour's car, parked over near the hedge. Come on, Pix, let's go, I'll put the lead on you. He's over there still, so I walk over to him and there's this parcel laying there against the wheel of the car. It was wrapped in newspaper, but very tightly bound up with string all the way up, right the way up, tightly bound. Now I piece it up. It's quite heavy because most of it's marble plimp. Tear a bit off the top. It was hard to do because this string was tightly bound all the way down. Tear a bit off and I could see that it was a sort of shallow cup and hands holding it like that. So I go down the other end and I'm ripping the other end and then there's some plaques. West Germany, Brazil.
Brazil had won the previous two World Cup finals and Germany the one before that. It could mean only one thing.
No, it can't be. So I run indoors, my then wife. I said, I think this is a World Cup. She knows nothing about sport, World Cup. I said, the World Cup. Oh, I'll tell you, I'm taking that to the police station. So I had a little old Ford, jumps in that and goes up to Gypsy Hill police station. Just pull up outside the door, bash straight through, swing the doors, the old sergeant steps back. Whoa. I said, I think I found the World Cup. I bang it on the thing. And he goes, what? I said, I think I found the World Cup, look. And his famous words were to me, doesn't look very World Cup-y to me, sonny. And my heart goes, oh no.
The police had reason to be dubious. The theft of the cup coincided with a university tradition known as Rag Week. It involved students playing pranks across town. The sergeant at the desk initially thought Dave had been duped by practical jokers. But to be sure, a detective was called through. He produced from under the counter a diagram of the World Cup with the exact measurements of its dimensions. Presumably all of the stations in London had been issued with one in case it was handed in. Dave was called to the detective's office.
Went through to the office and says, you know what, I said, I think it is. So my heart starts going again then because I thought, oh yeah, it's a bloody prank. And he says, oh, calm down. I go, oh God. And he goes over to the old drawer, pulls out a drawer and a bottle of whiskey and he says, drink that. I drop whiskey. He said, oh, I've got to get on to my boss.
These days, you'd be lucky to find a policeman at the desk when you go into a station, never mind one who would pour you a stiff whiskey to calm your nerves. Nonetheless, Dave still had a tense wait until the chief inspector arrived.
So he phoned some chief inspector who, when he came, was obviously at the do because he was all in a dicky bow tie and things like, you know. And he goes, what?
Once he realised what he had in his possession, he whisked Dave and the trophy off to Cannon Row Police Station in the centre of town for questioning. But even that was not a straightforward journey.
Jumps in the car, down through Brixton, traffic lights, car breaks down. Police car bloody breaks down. All the traffic lights, we're all sitting here, got a World Cup in Brixton. So the Brixton Police Station was over on the right, so they went there, got another car, took me up the Cannon Row, goes in the back, the press are there, so I don't know, I must have told them, sort of thing. Yeah, and there's a sort of big stairway leading up to the offices upstairs with the police and all that sort of thing, and sit down. A couple of high officials come in, police, you know, start asking me questions, and then suddenly dawned on me, oh, I'm going to be number one suspect here. I thought, God, have I done the right thing? Have I done the right thing here? You know, because they started, oh, date of birth, all this. Oh, no.
Dave was indeed what the police call a person of interest, and detectives quizzed him about his movements the previous Sunday. He said they also did background checks on his family to see if he was related to any possible suspects. By 2 a.m, Dave was free to go. But when he got home, there were more inquisitors, the media.
Mr. Carbard, how did you actually find the cup?
Well, I was going out to make a phone call to my brother, and I thought I'd take the dog with me.
Pickles became a national sensation and a hero. Corbett and Pickles even ended up being invited to the England team dinner at the Royal Garden Hotel in Kensington after they'd won the final.
I sat there and the street is closed with people packed all outside. Like, so I go up. You go in and dignitaries there and all this sort of thing. Got Pickles there, like, you know. And he goes and wheezes up against the lift, doesn't he? Oh, my God.
Brilliant. Only Pickles could do that and still be the star of the party.
Do you remember seeing any of the players then?
Yeah, I saw them.
Did they know who you were? Did they?
Oh, they knew about Pickles, yeah. Old Bobby Moore picked him up, yeah.
Picked up Pickles? Yeah. They obviously felt as if Pickles had helped them to get the glory.
I hope you give them a bit of luck.
Dave, a working-class Crystal Palace fan from south-east London, had, by the virtue of being Pickles' owner, found himself at the World Cup winners' celebratory dinner. It was the most exclusive party in the country that night, with even the Prime Minister Harold Wilson in attendance. If Dave wasn't already feeling awkward, then he was by the time Pickles cocked his leg against the lift. Another person at the Royal Garden Hotel was the first ever Minister of Sport, Dennis Howell. Recalling seeing Pickles on the day of the World Cup triumph, he wrote in his memoirs, "I could only reflect on how fortunate we were to have a dog that knew where to look. Now, on the balcony of the Royal Garden Hotel, sharing the adulation of the players, was the same hero. How on earth he ever got into the hotel, much less on the balcony, was as mysterious as how the trophy was first stolen and then recovered." You're listening to Stealing Victory. I'll be back after a short break. This is Stealing Victory. So Pickles enjoyed the fame, but what about the fortune? Dave got into something of a dispute with the FA over the reward, with both him and the FA boss, Joe Mears, claiming it. It clearly left Dave unimpressed. For a man who didn't seem to have a bad word to say about anyone, the first time the FA came up in conversation, he simply had this to say.
The dodgy FA.
Dave repeated his feelings about what he described as the dodgy FA a number of times during our conversation. But with regard to the reward money, he came out smiling. Here he is speaking to a BBC reporter.
And they seem pretty certain that I will get it, but I don't know.
They think you'll get it rather than Mr. Mears?
Yes, yes. Can't believe it. So,
Dave picked up around £6,000, worth over £110,000 today. It was six times more than what the England players got for winning the cup. While digging through the old police archives for this investigation, I noticed an intriguing inconsistency in his statements that I needed to run past him.
So, what we got here? 15. So, you gave one Cannon Row Police Station, 27th of March 1966. There you go, that's your first one. That just talks about you, what you'd done that day, finding the cup.
I live at the pub address, ground floor flat with my wife Jeannie.
In his first police statement, made on the day he found the cup, Dave said he didn't go out all day. But we know from the files that his then wife Jean said they'd all gone to Dave's nephew's christening a few miles away. Dave then made a second statement confirming the trip. Could he remember why he hadn't included it the first time?
No, that's my brother, my older brother.
Your other... Oh, you got two brothers?
John and fuck me, my brain's going. John and Michael were twins, older than me.
John was expecting a baby.
Yeah, John was expecting a baby. Michael had a baby.
And was being christened.
Yeah.
But you'd just forgotten to mention that on the night.
Well...
I mean, I guess you had had a lot going on, so...
Yeah.
Do you remember why you forgot to mention it first time?
I can't even remember making this statement, to be honest with you.
That's what I was going to ask you as well.
Yeah, I can't remember making this statement.
No.
I must have phoned him up to say that I made a mistake.
Dave went on to pick up his £6,000 reward, which he used to buy the cottage I interviewed him in. Pickles is buried in the back garden.
Ah, the sad story of Pickles. Now, he's a good dog. He took all this in his stride. Lovely. Kids loved him, but he didn't like cats, right? So one evening, I'm going out here for a walk, and my son then was, about 7 or 8. Went out the house. At the side of the house, there's an alleyway that goes up to the back. As we went into an alleyway, a cat jumped over the fence into the alleyway, and Pickles went. Son let go of the lead, and he was gone. We ran around after him, he's gone. Couldn't find him anywhere, So I jumped in the car, drove around the village, couldn't find him. Went back up the alleyway, and he was hanging in the tree. He must have chased the cat up the tree, and the lead flicked over. Because I just got hold of him, and he just come out. He must have broke his neck.
Author Martin Atherton joked there's a more sinister story to how Pickles ended up hanging from a tree.
That's the official story. My own belief is Pickles was silenced. It was a mob hit, I think. Because Pickles knew the truth of what had gone on, and I've got no evidence for that at all. We had a laugh with David about that. He said, I've thought that many a time that it might be.
Pickles the dog, long gone but certainly not forgotten. He's gone down in British folklore, and as far as yarns go, you couldn't really get any more British. Martin Atherton again.
It's found by a dog, and that's the story. That becomes the story, and it's stayed the story ever since. You tell anybody about it, say it's after the World Cup, what's the one thing everybody says? Pickles. 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 Nothing else. They don't know anything about it. It's found by a dog. And I think there was an extent to which, in modern parlance, that the story was spun that way as well, I think. Let's forget about we've been got out of jail by this dog. Oh, it's been found by a dog. Oh, isn't that lovely? You know, and then you see all these photographs of Pickles with his medal, Dog of the Year medal, his year's supply of dog food. Lots of people got a lot of publicity out of it as well. Positive publicity. Anything at all like that, it's almost like Pickles has become beyond an icon. Pickles saves nation.
Partly then, this is a story of failings by Scotland Yard, failings by the FA being forgotten about because of some good spin and the media just seemingly ignoring the real story and just going after the nice animal angle.
Yeah, because then by the time it's got back, we're getting in the run-up to the World Cup. And, of course, what do England do? England win it. That's all that's important. Because you think, yeah, it's all very shambolic and amateur, but actually as a PR exercise, it's really good. It's really, really good. Being found by a dog. I mean, if that was somebody's idea, you know, then that was brilliant. That was one of the best PR moves ever in the history of sport anywhere in the world. If it was just accidental, then, again, it didn't harm the story at all. But it took away from everything that had gone on that never really came out. But there's so much of this story that wasn't known and still isn't. But the incompetence itself, as we saw before, it's very hard to get angry about it. when you think about the ransom and the newspaper with the £5 notes on the end, we laugh about it. So there's still that element of humour. It's a humorous story. Yeah. The whole thing is a humorous story. You look at it in depth, it's an absolute disgrace what went on, but it's a humorous disgrace.
We all frame our world around stories. It seems to be the way the human brain is wired. Facts get lost in favour of a narrative, something simple that makes us feel good. Hero dogs have always been popular, from Jack London's Buck in Call of the Wild to Lassie. An expert at spotting a good story is political pundit and my Daily Mirror colleague, Kevin Maguire. So what's the tale he's grown up remembering from this whole saga?
I grew up on the story, World Cup is stolen and it's miraculously found by a dog, Pickles, and everything's all right. That's it. It was like almost a great British success story, all built around the dog, the heroic dog. You turn adversity into triumph. It's always something shiny at the end. So it's kind of always been presented as a good news, uncomplicated story. Some tea leaf out there nicks it, dog gets it, job done, all well.
But was there more? The man who had demanded a ransom for the cup, Ted Betchley, had promised to get it back. And 2 days later, it appears. Had the police done some kind of deal with Betchley? What's more, Betchley was given bail after managing to raise a surety close to £100,000 in today's money. This is from a man who was struggling to pay his £2 a week in rent. Where did the money come from? And then there's a front page splash by the Sunday Mirror on March the 27th, 1966. Dave Corbett found the cup later that day, but the headline, written the night before, predicted correctly, World Cup back in 48 hours. Crime reporter Norman Lucas wrote that the 80 detectives investigating the theft were confident that the trophy would be returned. How could they have been so sure it would come back within 48 hours? The more I looked into the story, the murkier it became. Kevin Maguire again.
I think the story we grew up hearing just sounds so much fiction now, and there's more holes in it than a colander, because it was given in a very simplistic way, and it feels to be more conspiracy along the way. It's just spun in one way, and yet when you delve behind it, it's far more fascinating because of it, but it tells you a lot about how power used to be exercised then, about who had control, about how the population, the country, was never told the truth. It's very, very telling about wider stuff about life back then.
I mean, it's just because of us English just seem to be obsessed with dog stories, as well, animal stories in general. So I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, the reporters got onto this and thought, hang on a second, there's a dog here. It seems to have got spun, and the story's changed, as stories do, and as we change the stories we tell each other and we like to hear.
If you're telling me that Pickles the dog really didn't find that trophy and it was just being taken for a walk and it was the owner that found it, next you'd be telling me Father Christmas doesn't exist. I mean, look, the old certainties are just ending now, aren't they? I mean, look, we've grown up on decades, more than half a century, of a dog finding that trophy, the hero dog, which got a lot of publicity out of it afterwards. And that's not happened. Well, it's kind of a barking conspiracy theory.
All this got me thinking about the whole Pickles story. So I went back to the archives and dug out Dave Corbett's original police statement made hours after the find. He'd said, "Just as we were about to go out of the gate, I was putting the lead on the dog when I saw a package at the side of a bush. It was wrapped in newspaper. I stooped down and picked it up and felt it was heavy." So Pickles didn't really find the cup at all, or Dave didn't claim that he did in that first statement. He was putting the lead on Pickles when he spotted it. But it was a better story to a nation of dog lovers if he did. So it seems the tale has developed over time, as they all do. As well as the identity of the thief, another gap in our knowledge is how the cup got to Dave's driveway in the first place. If I was going to find out, I needed to know if a villain from the Woolworth Road called Sidney Q, or was it Koo, had ever existed. If so, had he put it there? As I continued my search for Sidney Q, I was reading every newspaper story I could find on the theft. The last four sentences of a 2006 article in the Observer Sport Monthly had caught my eye. It was a quote from Betchley's son-in-law, John Stringer. He said, "I've been offered a few hundred pounds from some newspapers. It'll take a lot more for me to open my mouth. but I handled all my father-in-law's legal affairs at the time. And let me tell you, there is a twist that is yet to be revealed. This added to my gut feeling that there was something to the tip-off from my source, and it gave me hope that there could still be people alive who had new information. Maybe even Sidney Q was around. Stories are about people, and it's only people who give them to us journalists and help us to prove them. Sitting at a computer sending out freedom of information requests and searching Twitter only gets you so far. I would have to track down more people linked to the theft. So I delved deeper, and then another article caught my eye. It was an obscure piece in the letters section of the Surrey Mirror from August 2016. Headlined, "Plenty to the World Cup Tale We Were Not Told," by Frank Baldwin. He wrote,
"You don't have to be a football fan to remember that England won the World Cup on the 30th of July 1966 when they beat Germany 4-2 in the final at Wembley. But I've often wondered if Captain Bobby Moore would have been able to lift the famous Jules Rimet trophy had it not been for my late dad, Freddie Baldwin. He was a criminal law solicitor based in Bermondsey, South London, and the family law business he started is still based there today. Dad became involved in the World Cup when he was asked to act for Edward Bletchley."
Perhaps this was a way to learn more about Ted Bletchley, and there was more.
"However, the theft charges against Bletchley were dropped due to the efforts of my dad."
It would be interesting to discover what those efforts might have involved.
"Bletchley never revealed who the actual thieves were. Could it have been that a deal was broken between the thieves and the authorities for the cup to be found, with my father and Bletchley acting as intermediaries? If you wrote all these coincidences down as a script for a book or a film, people would probably say the story is too far-fetched."
It was time to track down Frank Baldwin and find out more about what he knew of the events of 1966. Coming up next on Stealing Victory.
"I've always believed that my father acted as an intermediary between the police, the FA, the government and the thieves themselves.
So I think it's a very clever thing to make the judge think, oh, well, I don't want to be the man that ruined the World Cup for England."
Stealing Victory is an original Audi production. If you've enjoyed listening, then please do like us on your podcast app, leave a review and subscribe. Our hashtag is Stealing Victory, all one word. More information can be found at audi.co/stealingvictory. Stealing Victory is written and hosted by me, Tom Pettifor, with thanks to everyone at the Daily Mirror for their support during the investigation. Sound design is by Norman Goodman. Theme music by Nick Reynolds and Edward Rose. Title music by Guy Farley. Executive editor is Owen Bennett-Jones. Editor-in-chief, Andrew Sampson. And series producer is Zach Brophy.